Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Murder in Manchuria, the true story of a Jewish virtuoso, Russian fascists, a French diplomat, and a Japanese spy in occupied China, by Scott D. Seligman, narrated by Eric Jason Martin. And in that bloody duel between the greedy, grasping, obstinate Slav and the newborn energies of the occidentalized Mongol, the Jew paid his full quota for the doubtful privilege of his domicile, the worst of stepmothers that have ever nursed the children of Israel. Rabbi Shevel Levin, the city of Harbin's first rabbi, as quoted in the Hebrew Standard, November 2, 1906. Harbin was great for the Jews, until it wasn't. Dara Horn, People Love Dead Jews, 2021. Introduction. When Semyon Kospe and Lydia Shapiro parted on a street in the city of Harbin near midnight on August 24, 1933, after a night of music and merriment, neither could anticipate the dark sequence of events the coming months held in store. The macabre aftermath would set the Manchurian Jewish community on edge, arouse worldwide opprobrium, and leave behind a mystery that was never fully solved. The tragedy that began that night in China's Wild East pulled in an improbable cast of Jewish merchants, Japanese military men, white Russian thugs, French diplomats, Chinese judges, and even an Italian spy for hire. It was a watershed event in the history of the so-called Empire of Manchukuo, a piece of northeast China forcibly carved off by the Japanese army in 1931. The fate of Semyon Kospe would help unmask Manchukuo as the Japanese puppet state it was. And it would herald the exodus of thousands of Russian Jews who had called the land home for several decades, helping to foil a grand Japanese plan to keep them there. The story of Semyon Kospe is the stuff of Harbin lore. Histories of the city unfailingly take note of it, and the preservation of many of the storied turn-of-the-century buildings in which Semyon and Lydia lived and played helps one imagine even today how it unfolded. The first time I heard about the Kospe family was when I visited Harbin with a group of friends from the Beijing Jewish community in the late 1990s, although I didn't learn the whole story at the time. On that trip, we made a special effort to locate the historic sites of Jewish interest. I learned that in its heyday, Harbin had been home to some 20,000 Jews, nearly all of whom disappeared in the run-up to the Second World War, or not long after it. But why they had come, and where they had gone, was a mystery to me, and there were none of them left to tell the story. We lodged at the Moderne, an iconic turn-of-the-century hotel built in 1913 to 1914 by Semyon's father, Yosef, a Russian-Jewish entrepreneur. Across the street, we enjoyed bowls of what turned out to be very authentic borscht at the ornate Hua Mei restaurant that had once been the Jewish-owned Mars restaurant. And we made pilgrimages to two imposing buildings, one a hostel and the other a social club that had once been synagogues, and visited the former Jewish gymnasium, where we interrupted a class of its current students, Chinese children of Korean extraction. One could still clearly make out the six-pointed Stars of David in the building's fenestration. Not to be missed was Huangshan, the site of the largest extant Jewish cemetery in East Asia. Located on the outskirts of the city, it is the repository of Harbin's remaining Jewish gravestones, which were removed from their original location in the city center between 1958 and 1962 to make way for new construction, though it is not the location of the actual graves. One can view Semyon's somewhat eroded tombstone there today. In my experience, to study Jewish history too often means to visit places where Jews used to live, but no longer do. For me, this has included parts of the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, and several cities in East Asia and on the subcontinent. The list also includes my hometown of Newark, New Jersey, which boasted a flourishing Jewish community of about 60,000 souls when I grew up there in the 1950s and 1960s. The magnificent old synagogue buildings still stand, most reincarnated as African-American churches. The cemeteries in which many of my forebears rest are also still there. But today, Newark probably counts fewer than 1,000 Jewish residents, the rest having long since fled to its suburbs. Newark's Jews came primarily from the Russian Empire, and they thrived in the city for about a century, give or take a decade or two, before moving on. But Russian Jews, just like my paternal grandparents, who headed east rather than west and wound up in Harbin, enjoyed a much shorter window there, about half the time, and unlike the Newarkers, who were in the main upwardly mobile and financially able to pack up and leave for suburbia, the Harbin Jews departed because they were more or less driven out. I never foresaw that I would someday learn enough about the Kospes to write a book about them and others who called Manchuria home in the early 20th century, still less one centered in the very Hotel Moderne in which I had stayed. In the process, I would learn the full story of the Harbin Jews, from the arrival of the first Jewish man in 1899 to the death of the last Jewish woman in 1985, and understand how the tragic story of Semyon Kospe contributed to the exodus of the community. And I would take a stab at solving the nearly century-old mystery of who was ultimately responsible for the young man's fate. Harbin's first Jews, like my grandparents, arrived at their destination at the turn of the 20th century, but nearly all were gone by 1949 when the communists took over China. For a short interval during those 5 decades, they felt safe from the oppression and violence that had plagued them in Russia. Eventually, however, Russians and their hatred caught up with them, and the arrival in 1931 of new Japanese overlords, who quickly joined forces with the Russians, made things for the Jews immeasurably worse. This is the story of the event in that short history, thought by many to be the harbinger of the end. Although the exodus had already begun a few years before it occurred, the Kospe case persuaded many that remaining was no longer prudent, and that, like so many other times in the history of our people, it was time to move on. Researching this story posed an unusual set of challenges. First, mirroring the various ethnicities represented in Harbin, relevant materials exist in Chinese, Russian, Japanese, French, Hebrew, Yiddish, and English, not all of which are languages I understand. I have relied on linguistic help from people, as well as from Google and DeepL, machine translation websites that do a remarkably good job of bridging the language divide. Second, as a historian, I have a strong preference for primary materials. In this case, however, owing in part to the fact that certain archival documents are inaccessible to me and that others were not preserved, I have had to rely a bit more on secondary sources than is my wont. As with my other works of narrative nonfiction, the characters depicted in this book have not in any way been fictionalized. They really existed, and the events really occurred at the times indicated, although I have occasionally been forced to make some educated guesses when sources disagreed or when I did not entirely trust them. Much of the dialogue was recorded at the time or in a memoir, though in a few instances I have condensed material to make for easier listening. And no thoughts have been attributed to people who left no records of them, nor have feelings or motives been ascribed to them that were not made explicit by their actions. A note on language and currency. I have used Harbin and Manchukuo instead of the technically correct but seldom encountered Harbin and Manjoguo, and I have employed a few European place names like Port Arthur, modern Dalian, and Manchuria, which were in popular use at the time of the action of the book and appear frequently in the source material. I've also left Chiang Kai-shek undisturbed, and have not romanized his name into the far less familiar Zheng Jieshi. I have used romanized versions of the original Russian names of Harbin's streets. Japanese names are presented in Western order, given name before surname, and not the way they would have been rendered in Japan. In the original materials, sums of money were expressed in both dollars and yen, which generally referred to Manchu Guo Yuan. Before 1935, when it was pegged to the Japanese yen, the Manchu Guo Yuan, sometimes also referred to as the gobi, was valued at 24 grams of silver. In 1933, 20 U.S. cents could buy 1 gram of silver. Modern-day equivalents, cited in the text, have been based on this exchange rate.
Prologue.
Semyon Kospe was young, handsome, dapper, talented, and full of joie de vivre. In the summer of 1933, the world was at his feet. A promising career as a concert pianist lay ahead of him. A recent graduate of the Paris Conservatory, he had pleased the French music critics, who had praised the vigor in his fingers and wrists and the frankness of pace and brashness in movement of his technique. In the few months since he had returned to Asia, he had performed to great acclaim in the bustling cities of Shanghai and Tokyo, and delighted audiences in his hometown of Harbin, a city with a robust music scene, with his interpretations of Mussorgsky and Chopin. And on the horizon, a rare opportunity beckoned, a concert tour of the United States. Semyon had grown up in privilege in Harbin, a major city in northeastern China, a region known to foreigners as Manchuria. His Russian-born father, Yosef, like many veterans of the Russo-Japanese War, had settled there in the first years of the century. A pillar of the local Jewish community, Yosef Kospe had built several businesses there. The crown jewel of his holdings was the fashionable Hotel Modern at 113 Kitayskaya Street in the city's waterfront Pristan district. It included an opulent jewelry store that dealt in Fabergé eggs and other Russian valuables. He and his wife, Marie, had given Semyon and his brother, Vladimir, the best primary and secondary education the city had to offer. In 1926, their mother had packed the two boys up and taken them to Paris to complete their studies. Since his return in mid-1933, Semyon, 24, an eligible bachelor, had been the toast of the town. Although the bulk of Harbin's population was Chinese and Semyon had studied their language, he spent little time among them. His life was lived within the expatriate community, replete with its concerts, recitals, dinners, parties, and romance. And he had taken up with a young woman whose background was similar to his own. He had probably known Lydia Chernetskaya in childhood, as she was, like him, the child of a local Jewish businessman and a talented musician. 4 years older than he, she had also lived in Europe. But unlike him, Lydia, now Lydia Shapiro, was married, and she was already the mother of four. However, she had recently left her husband, which had occasioned her return to her father's home in Harbin. But the Harbin of 1933 was not the city they had known in their youth. Much had changed since Lydia's departure in 1921 and Semyon's 5 years later. Whether Manchuria was even a part of China anymore was now very much in doubt. On a pretext, the Japanese army had seized control in 1931 and, after taking Harbin the following year, proclaimed the establishment of the Independent Republic of Manchu Guo. Japanese troops occupied the country, and Japanese officials controlled the levers of government. Corruption was rampant, and so was crime. Among Harbin's sizable Russian population were tens of thousands of white Russians, sworn opponents of the Bolsheviks, the lion's share of whom had fled Russia for their lives after the October Revolution. Some among them had established the Russian Fascist Party. Well-organized, though underfunded, it was deeply anti-Semitic, its members blaming Jews for fomenting the revolution that had led to their enforced exile from Mother Russia and their impoverishment. They had become especially belligerent under the new Japanese administration, were strongly suspected of torching Harbin's main synagogue, and were almost certainly behind several recent kidnappings of local Jews. The Jewish community had begun to feel especially vulnerable. Semyon was surely aware of the danger. His father certainly was. The elder Kospay knew he was a target. He had been excoriated in a right-wing Russian-language newspaper for supposedly dealing in ill-gotten goods. It was even alleged, preposterously, that these included the Romanov family jewels. The paper had also improbably branded this successful businessman a communist, an accusation for which it provided no evidence. He now seldom left the Moderne, where he and his son were living, and when he did venture out, it was with a posse of bodyguards in tow. Semyon didn't share his father's sense of vulnerability. He often went out to friends' nighttime parties and regularly drank at the American bar on Konya Street, often in the company of Lydia. But although he wasn't willing to forgo social life, he did accept his father's offer of a car with an armed chauffeur. Not that it did him much good. On the evening of August 24th, 1933, he had a date with Lydia. Another couple joined them for dinner and a musical evening at the Moderne. When the party ended, just after midnight, he did the gentlemanly thing and escorted her home. Lydia lived not far from the Moderne, and Semyon ordered his driver to see her to her father's house. Of Semyon and Lydia, however, only she would make it home safely that night. 1. Tug of War. Between the late 19th century and the end of World War II, the vast land of Manchuria had the misfortune of being coveted by three countries. One of them, China, the one that arguably had the strongest historical claim to it, was weak and ultimately unable to protect it from the designs of the other two. The region fit handily into the strategic plans of both Russia and Japan to expand their spheres of influence, plans that would be difficult to execute without suzerainty over the area. As a result, Manchuria's sad destiny was to be fought over, invaded, and colonized. The region, which consisted of the three modern Chinese provinces of Liaoning, Jilin, and Heilongjiang, and parts of today's Inner Mongolia, was, at 400,000 square miles, quite a bit larger than Texas. More than twice the size of Japan, it bordered on Russia to the north and east, Mongolia to the west, the rest of mainland China to the southwest, and Korea to the southeast. Its traditional Chinese name, Guangdong, east of the pass, in Mandarin, signified the lands beyond Shanhai Guan, the easternmost pass of the Great Wall of China, where the wall meets the sea. Largely unspoiled, the Manchurian terrain was rich in natural resources, including vast virgin forests, abundant arable land, and extensive deposits of coal, iron, and precious metals like gold and silver. But it was also quite frigid, especially in winter, when Siberian winds forced temperatures in its northern reaches as low as minus 58 degrees Fahrenheit, and the ground froze to a depth of 4 feet. The south was more temperate. The fertile fields of southern Manchuria produced abundant harvests of soybeans, sorghum, maize, and wheat. And Port Arthur, on the Yellow Sea, was an ice-free harbor. Beginning in the late 17th century, Manchuria had been controlled by Beijing. After its own native Jurchen people, later known as Manchus, breached the Great Wall, overthrew China's Ming Dynasty, and established the Qing Dynasty in 1644, there was no question about its status as a part of the Chinese Empire. But it was a special part. For most of their reign, which lasted until 1912, the Manchu emperors kept their sparsely populated sacred ancestral homeland as unspoiled as they could. They discouraged ethnic Chinese from migrating there, although they couldn't prevent a considerable illegal inflow of Chinese farmers, whom Manchu landlords hired to work their fields. In the 1860s, however, that restriction was lifted, and by 1900, Chinese made up the vast majority of Manchuria's 17 million people. China's humiliating defeats at the hands of European powers in the two Opium Wars of the 19th century, which forced it to grant them special trading rights and pried its ports open to foreign commerce, had exposed its vulnerabilities. Not long afterward, during the waning years of the Qing dynasty, central control over China's hinterlands weakened. At the turn of the 20th century, two wars were fought over Manchuria. What became known as the First Sino-Japanese War began in 1894 when China and Japan clashed over Korea, traditionally a Chinese client state. Within months, Japan defeated Chinese ground troops and destroyed the Chinese navy, and its soldiers pursued Chinese troops across the Yalu River, which divided Korea from Manchuria. Japan took control of Port Arthur and chased the Chinese through southern Manchuria and into Shandong Province before the war was over. The 1895 treaty that ended that war marked a humiliating defeat for China's Qing dynasty and cemented Japan's status as a major power in Asia. China was forced to open several ports to Japanese trade, pay a large indemnity, and cede control over various lands on its mainland's periphery, including Korea, Taiwan, the Pescadores Archipelago, and southern Manchuria's Liaodong Peninsula. Japanese control of this peninsula, however, alarmed Russia. Russia also had designs on Port Arthur, which sat at its tip. The Tsar's Pacific Fleet was based in Vladivostok, whose port froze up in cold weather for as long as half a year. Port Arthur would offer him year-round access to the Sea of Japan and the ability to project power into the Pacific. Conspiring with Germany and France, two other European nations active in China at the time, Russia forced the Japanese to withdraw. It was a grievance Japan would nurse for a long time, made all the more galling when Russia itself then seized control of the region. In 1896, Russia entered into a strategic alliance with the shell-shocked Qing government to prevent further Japanese encroachment in the territory. In exchange, Russia was granted a concession to build a railroad through the heart of Manchuria that would complete its Trans-Siberian line by linking it to Vladivostok on the coast. Russia would exercise political control in a swath of territory on either side of the rail line. Building the line through Manchuria instead of eastern Siberia shortened the route by 560 miles, saving money and time, and Russia moved in men and materials rapidly to begin construction of what became known as the Chinese Eastern Railway. A year and a half later, it signed an additional agreement to lease the Liaodong Peninsula, develop Port Arthur for its Far East Fleet and Merchant Marine, and build the South Manchuria Railway, a 550-mile southern spur to the port from Harbin. With the completion of the railroad in 1902, Russia became the dominant player in Manchuria. This rattled Japan, which proposed a deal. It would not challenge the Tsar's dominion over Manchuria if Russia guaranteed not to move into Korea. But negotiations broke down, and in early 1904, the Japanese Navy staged a surprise attack on Port Arthur. It damaged and blockaded the entire Russian fleet in the opening salvo of what became known as the Russo-Japanese War. Japanese ground forces once again moved through Korea into Manchuria, though this time it was the Russian army that they beat back. When Russia finally sued for peace after 18 months, it was forced to turn over Port Arthur and the South Manchuria Railway to Japanese control. The defeat did not signal the departure of all Russians from Manchuria, however. Russia retained control of the Chinese Eastern Railway Zone, and those Russians already in Manchuria remained. After the war, in fact, their numbers swelled as decommissioned soldiers like Yosef Kospay, who saw little benefit in returning to Mother Russia, chose to settle there. After 1912, when China's Qing dynasty collapsed, the new Republic of China that replaced it nominally inherited Manchuria, which, in addition to its indigenous population of Chinese and various Manchu tribes, was now home to a large complement of Russians and Japanese, as well as Koreans and other minorities. But the internationally recognized Chinese government in Beijing was too weak to exercise any control over Manchuria. Zhang Zuolin, a former bandit and soldier turned warlord, was the real law in the region, and despite being Chinese, he struck a sweetheart arrangement with Japan. In return for Japan's military and financial support, he protected her interests. Japan would not for long remain content with the status quo in Manchuria, on whose agricultural products and vast mineral wealth she had come to depend. Before too much time had passed, she would move to possess the region in its entirety. 2. Harbin, Cosmopolis in the North. It was in more or less the geometric center of Manchuria, at the point where the tracks crossed the Sungari River, that Russia set up the headquarters of the Chinese Eastern Railway, and that is where, and why, the city of Harbin was established. Innumerable Chinese cities have storied histories dating back thousands of years, but Harbin is not one of them. Before 1898, the location, about 350 miles west of Vladivostok, 520 miles north of Port Arthur, and 650 miles northeast of Beijing, was the site of a small rural settlement. The constant danger of flooding from the river made it a problematic location for a city, but proximity to the water made it a good logistical bet for the Russians. The Sungari was a tributary of the Amur River, called the Heilongjiang in Chinese, which was accessible from the Sea of Japan. This meant men and materials could reach the area, which lacked usable roads, relatively easily by water. That is, they could do so between April and November, when the Sungari was navigable. Access was impossible when it froze in winter time. Building and administering a railroad required importing construction material from Russia, Europe, and the United States, since there was no local manufacturing infrastructure. Maintenance shops, switching stations, depots, and storehouses all had to be built, as did hospitals and schools, to support the families of the planners, surveyors, engineers, technicians, clerks, construction workers, security guards, and civil servants who came. Fully 12,000 Russians had arrived in Harbin by 1900, as well as tens of thousands of Chinese recruited for railway construction jobs. Because the city was located in the railway right-of-way, which was about 1,000 miles long and 31 miles in width, it was completely under Russian control. China retained no authority there. Harbin was not only the headquarters of the railway, it was also the hub of the Russian military presence, the center of Russian commercial and industrial development, and the headquarters of the Russian-run legal system, such as it was, whose jurisdiction was limited to the railway corridor. Only Russians and Chinese were permitted to own land there. Although the city was located in China, one would never have suspected that from its layout or its architecture. Nowhere to be seen in Pristan, Harbin's commercial center, were the narrow, random lanes, the winding alleys, and the Buddhist temples with their graceful upturned eaves that one saw all over China. Harbin had been laid out on a grid by Russian city planners, and it featured public squares and parks, visual axes and broad boulevards, many as wide as 140 feet. With its soft curves, huge central archway, and triangular plaza, the imposing Art Nouveau railway station, which opened in 1899, would not have been out of place in a European capital. The bulbous, onion-domed cupola of the massive 175-foot-high St. Sophia Orthodox Cathedral, built in 1906.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?